Hello, America and the world. This is Radio Free Market, and I'm your guest host, Drew Yelm, sitting in for Radio Free Market founder, Michael McKay. We are behind the lines of socialism, my friends, and Radio Free Market is the voice of free people and free markets. Today's topic is Banking Demystified, a discussion of Murray Rothbard's Mystery of Banking with Patrick Barron. Hello, Pat.
Hello, Drew.
Patrick Barron has been a consultant to the banking industry since 1985. He teaches bank management simulation at the Graduate School of Banking in the University of Wisconsin-Madison. He also teaches Austrian economics at the University of Iowa. And in banking, have you always been interested in Austrian economics, or how did your interest in this come about?
Well, I must admit that I was not always, I didn't even know about Austrian economics. I was probably just like many of your listeners in that, it's not a mainstream thing. You don't read about Austrian economics in the paper each day. You read about Keynesianism and maybe Milton Friedman's monetarism. I actually stumbled upon Austrian economics many years ago, and I don't even know when it was, but it was sometime probably 20 years ago, and it was a modest sponsor to the Cato Institute in D.C., and they offered a book called The Essence of Hayek, and it was a book of some of Friedrich Hayek's the best parts of his books, let's say, and that just got me interested, and of course from there. That led me to, Hayek would talk about this guy by the name of Ludwig von Mises, and from there, the world just expanded into the world of Austrian economics, and I just felt as if I finally found something that I had been looking for a very long time, which was something that just plain made sense. Other things just did not make sense to me, and this did.
In the banking field recently, the former chairman of the BBT Bank, his name is John Allison, he's come out as a big supporter of RAND and Austrian economics as well. Is Austrian economics very well known inside the banking industry?
No, it isn't. Now, this is another interesting thing. I don't think that you should expect that bankers really understand the industry of banking. And you may find that this is odd. But when you're actually in the industry, you're doing the day-to-day things, and a great deal of this is understanding Federal Reserve Bank regulations and other regulations that you have to abide by. And so the fact that the money supply may be expanding or contracting, or the Fed is doing things that would cause an unsustainable bubble, is really lost to bankers because they are dealing with what the Austrians would call the data of the market. And the data of the market is the interest rate as it is. So they're saying the interest rate is as it is. Can I buy money at that interest rate and re-lend it at a high enough rate that I can make a profit? So the whole idea of bankers understanding that the very commodity, which is money, that they deal with may be fictitious in a certain way is really not something that they consider. This is really the realm of economists. So I don't think that you'll find many bankers, with a few exceptions out there, that you'll find many bankers that really understand Austrian economics or really care. They're dealing with the data of the market as it is.
Well, and as we'll see later on, there's actually with a lot of the larger banks, there's actually kind of a pernicious element when you start talking about central banking. But we're coming up quickly here on a break, but before a break, I want to start talking about why you have chosen to teach the Murray Rothbard's Mystery of Banking. In the past 2 years, you've used it as one of your primary materials in the class, so I just kind of wanted to start talking about why you would talk about that.
Well, yeah, in the few seconds we've got left, there's probably no better book that takes you from ground zero right up through fractional reserve banking, what money is, and explains what kind of animal we're actually dealing with here.
All right.
When we come back from the break, we'll talk more about it.
Yep. Please stay tuned to Radio Free Market. We'll be back in just a moment. Please stay tuned. Welcome back to Radio Free Market. I'm your guest host, Drew Yelm, and on the phone with me is Patrick Barron, who's instructor of Austrian economics at the University of Iowa. And we were just talking about why he decided to teach Murray Rothbard's Ministry of Banking. So if you could please continue on that thought.
Well, yeah, thanks, Drew. I found that, of course, Murray Rothbard is just wonderful in so many ways. And in fact, the first book that I read of his that really got me thinking about the Fed was he has had a book out called The Case Against the Fed. And I'll tell you, when I first read this, I had not been exposed to Austrian economics, and I was in banking, as I am today, a bank consultant, and I thought, well, this is almost blasphemy. I can't believe this is he's against the very institution that we buy services from, that lends money to us as a banking industry when times are difficult, and if we happen to run into problems. And we, I knew people at the Fed. I was actually the representative of a bank that I worked for, which is a fairly large regional bank. I was the bank's representative to the Fed and other bigger banks. So I knew these people. They were good people. And then, but Murray Rothbard opened my eyes to all of this. And then I saw that he had this book called The Mystery of Banking, and it was reissued by the Mises Institute. It had been passed around sort of in a dog-eared copies for a long time, and they were able to reissue it in a nice hardbound copy at a very reasonable price. And now the Mises Institute actually has it. It's free on their website. You can download the book in a PDF format. But I just found that what Murray Rothbard did with this book was he would take someone who really didn't even have to have a background in economics, and he would explain, well, what really is money? He would talk about how money is an integral part of the market economy, how it is just as susceptible, you might say, to the laws of economics, for example, the law of supply and demand, and the law of the marginal utility, the law of marginal utility, which means that if you increase something by a unit, that unit is slightly less valuable than all units that are previous to that. And then he explains the background of banking and what fractional reserve banking actually is, and how fractional reserve banking came to be accepted as legal, unfortunately. And then he takes you right up through the implications of all that, and how fractional reserve banking ultimately causes boom bust business cycles, and that it's all a chain. And then, of course, the boom bust business cycles are threatens banks, because banks are actually creating money out of thin air. We can kind of get into that later, Drew. Mm-hmm. But when banks saw that they were going through periodic crises where there would be runs on their institutions and they wouldn't be able to honor all their deposits, so the big banks would get together and really conspire, which they did in the U.S., they conspired to mount a public relations campaign to tell the people that the nation needed a central bank. We had not had one. We had two central banks early in the Republic. So we wound up with a central bank that would be this lender of last resort, and then how that was gradually eroded, how the central bank eroded the value of money. We went off the gold standard, not just in one fell swoop, but in many, many little steps, incremental steps, and finally to today, where we're not on the, there's no link to the dollar or any currency really in the world to gold or silver or any other commodity of real value whatsoever.
Just some of the things I've noticed reading the book that I really like is that even though, you know, Austrians are not, they don't tend to like mathematical models or graphs, but what Murray Rothbard does in like the first half of the book is he goes through and he shows, like you were talking about with the law of diminishing marginal utility, where the purchasing power of money decreases as you have more money, and he shows this in graphical form, which for many who are not, I guess, educated in economics, this can be really helpful for them to see it in kind of more pictorial format. And also, too, like you said, just putting everything in the historical context, the creation of central banks, throughout history, how that worked out is also very excellent how he does that. So I guess what we could start talking about now is getting into exactly what fractional reserve banking is. So when you put your money in a bank, does the money that you put in the bank stay in the bank, or how exactly does that work?
Well, it does not, of course. The banks have a great incentive to take that money that you think is there for you to draw upon when you want it, but the banks see this as a deposit that you make as something that they can lend out and make money on. So the history of fractional reserve banking, you really have to understand the history of it to understand how pernicious this really is and how damaging this is. So if it started with, gold has been money since time immemorial. Also silver. Of course, many commodities have been used as money, even down to, shells and things like this. But essentially, the precious metals have emerged as primarily being chosen by the market as a medium of exchange. And gold is always, has always, in all cultures, in all places, at all time, gold has been used as money. Well, in olden days, there was just money. There was nothing, no such thing as fractional reserve banking. There was gold, and you had to protect your gold. Gold was in high demand for its intrinsic value. It's small, yet it's highly desired. It doesn't tarnish. It's easily divisible. It can be made into coins, or it can be re-smelted into candlesticks. It can be used for all kinds. Even today, it has medical purposes and industrial purposes. So there's also that underlying intrinsic value of gold, that even if it were not money, there's still a demand for gold for other reasons. But essentially, gold is money, and money was gold. But people saw that, having gold was it's a valuable thing, and to have it sort of stuffed under your mattress was not very safe. But goldsmiths, these were men who worked with gold to make mainly objects of ornamentation, had big vaults where they safe kept their own gold, and people started going to the goldsmiths and paying them a small fee to put their gold with the goldsmiths.
This would be like the introduction of deposit banking, correct?
Yes, and that's exactly what it was. It was what legally would be considered a bailment, meaning I'm giving you this object for you to put in your vault, and when I go to you, I want that object back. Well, with gold, it wasn't really all that necessary, for gold dust or gold bars are they're all the same. So you didn't really necessarily need to get your exact quantity of gold dust back, or gold bars back. You could take any gold of the same weight and of the same fineness back. Well, the goldsmiths started to realize that not everyone was coming in and asking for their gold very often, so they could go out and make purchases. So the goldsmiths realized that they could make some money on the side by lending out a portion of the gold that had been entrusted with them. Because let's just say they had 100, let's just say they had 100 ounces of gold on deposit. At any one day, people may come in and only want 5 or 10 ounces of gold. So they had lots of gold that they could lend out and make money on. This was the beginning of fractional reserve banking, because the reserve, instead of there being 100% reserves for everyone's deposit, now there was less than 100% reserves. In other words,
This distinction, with no other type of, asset would anybody else allow this to happen. Like, if you were to take your car and put it into a parking garage, you would not allow the parking garage operator to loan your car out to somebody, because what you'd end up doing is giving two people the claim to the same thing. It seems like it'd be a little bit fraudulent. So how exactly did it come about that banking in this manner was able to stay legitimate?
Well, of course, the goldsmiths didn't want anyone to know about this. This was hidden from them, hidden from the public. But when the public would get wind that Mr. Goldsmith down the street is really lending a lot of gold, people would say, "Well, wait a minute, I have my gold with him. I'm going to go down there. I'm going to run down there and get my gold." And thus became, this is how the bank runs started. You know, literally, people would run to the bank to get their gold. And, of course, we now call that a run on a bank. And people would be lined up to get their gold, and the goldsmith would not have enough gold because he had lent it out and people had spent the money, and he couldn't call in his loans fast enough to honor all of his debts, so he would go insolvent. So bank runs have been around a long time.
Okay, so we're talking about gold, but how exactly did it come about that we went from having gold to having banknotes?
Well, a banknote is really a certificate, and to certify something means that I certify that there is gold of this amount in Mr. Goldsmith's, what they would now call his bank. So a certificate, a gold certificate, was really nothing more than a warehouse receipt, saying here's a warehouse receipt for 5 ounces of gold. And these morphed into certificates of, well, here is a certificate for 5 ounces of gold. And then people started actually trading the certificates. So when they wanted to buy something, instead of taking their 5-ounce gold certificate, going to the goldsmith, drawing out their gold, and then walking to buy a horse or something, they just would go to the owner of the horse and say, "Would you take my 5-ounce certificate that so there's, which certifies that there is 5 ounces of gold in the bank?" And that's how we got notes.
We're coming up here on a break on Radio Free Market. We don't have enough time to really get into the meat of Fractional Reserve Banking and the history of it. But after the break, we're going to talk more about the lawsuits and the laws that were created to allow Fractional Reserve Banking. So please stay tuned. And we're back on Radio Free Market. I'm Drew Yelm, your guest host. I'm talking with Patrick Barron about the Ministry of Banking. And before the break, we were talking about how Fractional Reserve Banking started, but really kind of it took a lot of legal precedent to get Fractional Reserve Banking to become tolerated. How exactly did that come about?
Yes, it's a good question, Drew. Why do the legal authorities tolerate Fractional Reserve Banking? Because banks are creating liabilities and assets out of nothing. When I say they create a liability, I mean when the bank makes a loan, that's an asset on the bank books. You owe the bank money, so that's their asset. But they credit your checking account, or they actually, in olden days when the banks could still print their own currency, their own certificates, they'd actually hand you a stack of bills. Well, where did that money come from? Well, it came out of thin air. So why is that tolerated? And unfortunately, as Murray Rothbard explains very clearly in The Mystery of Banking, there were two court cases in England in the early part of the 19th century that have been adopted all over the world. Unfortunately, they've been adopted here in America as precedents, even though they were English laws, but they do dovetail with the political powers that be that want Fractional Reserve Banking, as we'll explain, I think, later in the program. But these two court cases were brought about. They were separate cases, and they were a little bit different, but each one involved a depositor in a bank that failed. There was a run on a bank, and the banker, of course, did not have the assets, did not have the actual money to give to his depositors. So in two court cases that were just a few years apart in the early part of the 19th century, the plaintiffs went to the court and said, I want the banker to pay me my money out of his personal assets, not out of his corporate assets, not out of the bank's assets, because the bank is insolvent. I gave that banker money to safekeep for me, to deposit and to hold safe for me, so when I needed the money, I would have it, and he took the money illegally and invested it for his own benefit. And unfortunately, twice the English court said, no, you just thought that you deposited the money with the banker. What you really did is you lent the money to the banker for him to do with as he pleased. And when you did that, You lost control over that. Yes, he did lose the money, and that's just too bad. That is unfortunate, but that's what you did voluntarily. And, of course, that's not what people thought they were doing.
I was just going to say, and with regard to the court case, I mean, there's a lot of precedent even in England about with that, with starting with the formation of the Bank of England, where they would allow the bank, the Bank of England, to have sole privilege to suspend specie payment.
Yes, that was that's always been the case. That and that's because in England, the crown, which is that's what they call the government, the crown, and in America, the government, they are the ones that benefit the most from this, because they benefit the most from the banks create money out of thin air, because they buy the government's or the crown's debt. And in England, the crown granted the Bank of England special privileges within the London trade zone, which of course was the most important trade zone, and did not allow competing banks to enter. They said the Bank of England would be the sole issuance of its own, of the certificates that could circulate within London. And therefore, of course, when the inevitable run on the bank, there's nothing special about the Bank of England that would prevent a run, then the government said, well, we allow the Bank of England to suspend specie payment, which means if you go to the bank with your pound note, you're not going to be given the equivalent amount of gold that you were supposed to get, which is about a fourth of an ounce of gold. So this is a special privilege that the banks enjoyed, and it's strictly arbitrary. It's a creation of the government, and banks should be susceptible, should be governed by the same commercial laws as a grain elevator, for example. A grain elevator actually is a good example of how a deposit bank should work. When a farmer deposits his grain in a grain elevator, these are these giant silos that we all see, especially in the Midwest, he gets a receipt. And this same is sort of like a bank, just like a bank would give a depositor a receipt. Now, when the farmer goes to sell his grain, he's not selling the exact kernels of grain that he deposited. Grain is fairly ubiquitous, meaning it's all pretty much the same quality. At least it is by the time it gets into the grain elevator, because when the farmer deposits the grain, it has to be have a certain moisture content, so it won't rot. So the grain elevator will accumulate grain from many farmers, and then the farmers...
Are the grain elevators able to loan out grain, or how exactly does that relate to fractional reserve banking?
Well, no, that's the point. Grain elevators are not allowed to loan out the grain because they don't own the grain. They're just hired to safekeep the grain, so to speak, for the farmers. And when the farmers decide to sell, then they sell a quantity of grain that's not exactly their kernels of grain that they're selling, but they will sell, say, you know, I want the farmer says, Farmer Brown says, sell my 10,000 bushels of grain today, please, at this price, and the grain elevator will do that. It's not allowed to do that, but yet fractional reserve banks are allowed to lend out money, and when you call and want your money, it isn't there.
This legal precedent is definitely amazing, how the banks could just go ahead and just get away with not even giving back their obligations, not making good on their obligations like that. But after the break, what we're going to do is we're going to talk more about the mystery of banking, and particularly we're going to talk about how the banking laws of Britain kind of transitioned to the United States, along with the creation of central banks over here in the United States. So please stay tuned to Radio Free Market. We'll be talking more with Patrick Barron after the break. Welcome back to Radio Free Market. I'm your guest host, Drew Yelm, and on the phone with me is Patrick Barron, and we're talking about Murray Rothbard's book, The Mystery of Banking. Before the break, we were talking about fractional reserve banking, the history of it, the legal precedents that established it as a viable business, and other sorts of businesses that also sort of, I guess, related to fractional reserve banking in such a manner. But I guess we're going to turn more to the states now. Now, before, there have been three national banks in the United States, correct?
Yes, that's right. The first national bank did not last very long. And in fact, the first two national banks were actually chartered for specific periods of time. The second bank of the United States was the one that was really, I think, the test case for the United States, in that Nicholas Biddle was the chairman of the bank, the president of the bank, and this was in the early part of the 19th century, and it was a source of vast corruption. Now, by corruption, I'm not saying that the people were stealing money, but they were, in effect, getting special privileges. And Andrew Jackson was just livid about this. In fact, this is why Andrew Jackson, who was a great war hero from the War of 1812, why he ran for president, because he was just disgusted with what was going on. He was a hard money man, and he saw that the Second Bank of the United States was showering special privileges on its favors, on Nicholas Biddle's buddy, so to speak. Andrew Jackson waged a war against the Second Bank of the United States for his entire eight-year presidency, and he won.
Well, I remember reading that Nicholas Biddle, who was the president of the Second Bank of the United States, he told Andrew Jackson that if he were to go ahead and try to end the bank, that he would actually engineer a recession, and he actually did.
Well, he said a lot of things. I mean, Biddle told Jackson that presidents come and go, but banks are eternal. And Jackson said, oh, no, they're not. They have charters that run out. In fact, Jackson just had to stop the extension of the charter for the Second Bank of the United States because, like I said, at that time, they were chartered for a specific period of time, and that time ran out in 1837, which was at the end of Jackson's administration. So Jackson was able to win, and the charter was not renewed, and the United States, there was a great transformation of the United States after this because the land had been greatly inflated, special privileges had been showered on not only on state banks, allowing them to suspend specie payment because, of course, when you issue money that is unbacked by real savings, then you cause all kinds of malinvestment in the economy. So then the government says, well, we can't have this. We've got to, so we can't have the banks fail, even though they've killed themselves. We've got to protect the banks by, in effect, allowing the banks to cheat the citizens, their depositors. And Jackson was just livid about this. He's one of the great presidents and one that we've ever had and one of the great champions of the common man.
Well, and with this, this free banking era, this time after the Second Bank, before the Federal Reserve, this free banking era, they call it free banking, but it really wasn't all that free. I mean, they allowed these banks to suspend specie payments, and they didn't allow them to branch out and diversify. And also, too, the expansion of the banknotes was tied to the state government bonds. It was kind of an interesting scenario they call free banking.
Well, you're very well averse in all this, much better than I am, in fact, Drew. But it's very indicative of government that any time there is a big industry, government just cannot keep its hands off of it. You know, the government got itself involved in railroads, and of course, and lately it's been getting itself involved in the housing market, and it's bailing out automobile companies, and of course, it's been hand in glove with defense contractors like Lockheed for years, keeping these really horribly run companies keeping them solvent by their bailouts. But the only good thing about what was good about the 19th century is we did not have a central bank. And I think this is important for our listeners to know that from 1837 until 1913, and 1913 is when the Federal Reserve Bank was chartered, our third central bank, but they chose to call it the Federal Reserve Bank, there was no central bank in the United States, and yet the United States enjoyed the largest period of growth probably in the history of the world. There was no central bank, and we were on a gold standard in that when we talk about fractional reserves, the reserves that we're talking about as the fraction thereof was gold for the most part. There was some silver, but mostly it was gold. And that meant that the banks could not get too far away, couldn't inflate too much and get too far away from this actual reserve of gold. So they could inflate maybe 3, 4, or 5 times, but eventually this would lead to the bank runs. And this was why even during the 19th century, the United States had periodic boom-bust cycles, but they were not nearly as bad as the one we had in that started in 1929. If we did not have a central bank, it would have been another relatively sharp recession/depression that might have lasted a year or two, and then we would have been off and running again.
Well, in the research I've read says that basically during this period of free banking, the business cycles were no more frequent than they are today.
Oh, they were, yes, and they were no more frequent, and Austrian scholars have researched this and determined that they were not nearly as bad. Especially the one in the 1890s was, has usually been viewed as, well, there was a long recession, but it wasn't really true. Research shows that the economy really was progressing quite nicely. Now, there were problems in a lot of places in the economy, but the economy did advance. So at least gold anchors you to something real. But the point that we should make here is that, we did still have boom-bust cycles because of this terrible thing called fractional reserve banking. And now today, I think, we want to discuss, well, what happens? Why is fractional reserve banking so bad? Because, it does cause a boom, and why can't the boom continue? And this gets into the Austrian theory of the business cycle, if you'd like to discuss that now, Drew.
Talk more about the formation of the Federal Reserve System. I mean, it's okay. Often said that they formed it as a means to, temper the business cycle, to be a lender of last resort. What exactly do they mean by being a lender of last resort?
Well, that's a good point. It really wasn't designed to be to temper the business cycle. It was designed to bail out the big banks. Now, so what happens is the chain of events is this. Banks engage in fractional reserve banking. For a while, this looks wonderful. Business is spurred because you are encouraging businesses to begin that should not begin because there is not a source of real savings. The citizenry has not decided to become more future-oriented and consume less today and save more for the future, and it is this savings that really funds investment. But you're not really doing that. You're just printing pieces of paper. So eventually this all must reverse itself. And there's a great book out there that I would recommend in addition to Rothbard's The Mystery of Banking, but this one is by a Spanish economist by the name of Huerta de Soto, and it's called Money, Bank Credit, and Economic Cycles. And De Soto explains very well why the boom cannot continue, and he explains the process by which the boom eventually deteriorates. So when that boom deteriorates, well, now the banks are in trouble because their loans are no good. And when their loans are no good, they're not getting the money back in so they can pay off their normal depositors. Well, now they're going to be insolvent. And these are the great men of the era. These are the Rockefellers and the Morgans. Those were the two big blocks, the Rockefellers and the Morgans, but they were usually at war with one another. But in this case, they actually got together, they conspired, and there's a great book out there called The Creature of Jekyll Island. They actually met in secrecy on Jekyll Island in the southeast U.S. and met and said, what we really need to do is to get another central bank in here that can be a lender of last resort, meaning when my bank gets in trouble, this central bank can lend me money, or it can allow me to suspend specie payment. But mainly, it can lend me money to tide me over, and we can tax the rest of the people in some way for this, and I can keep my vast banking empire going instead of being shown to be a bankrupt, just a terrible bankrupt like happens to any business.
And immediately after the Federal Reserve was formed in 1913, they already started having massive effects on the economy. They had formed in 1913. In 1914, they halved the reserve requirements. And then overseas, you had World War I starting, and they doubled the money supply so that they could then inflate the money supply for the benefit of the war.
This is just another illustration of how the banks benefit from the government, and the government benefits from the bank. So you've got this hand-in-glove mutually supporting conspiracy here of the government providing the banks with special favors. They are not subject to the normal commercial laws that the rest of us are in every other business. And that's because the banks buy the government's debt. They monetize the debt, and the government gets to spend money that the people would not willingly allow it to do, either through taxes or by honest borrowing. So this shows where this, and the central bank is the linchpin to all of this. And this is the great evil. But yet we've been brainwashed over the years that the Federal Reserve Bank is our friend, and it prevents boom bust business cycles. It does absolutely the opposite. It fosters boom bust business cycles. And because it allows the government to engage in all its foolish pump priming and spending enterprises that just waste capital.
And, well, I mean, you hit the nail on the head when you said that the government has an incentive to inflate. And I kind of wanted to, move a little bit to your recent Mises Daily article, "The Fed Recruits Academia to Its Brave New World of Monetary
yeah.
Policy." I thought that was an aptly titled piece because, we've got all these aggregates. I mean, we just want GDP to be big. But, I mean, what does GDP even mean?
Well, this is something else that you never hear the government talking about anything anymore except gross national product or gross domestic product. They're a little bit separate, but for our point, we'll just sort of treat them as interchangeably. But that's really final sale. So all you're ever reading the government is, so they're very happy when retail sales go up, for example. I just saw a piece in the Wall Street Journal that stock market booms on retail, advance in retail sales. So what they want us all to do is to go out and spend. They want us to spend our capital, because that's what they count. They count final sales. But again, as Huerta de Soto explains magnificently in his book Money, Bank Credit, and Economic Cycles, at least 70% of the economy is not final sales. 70% of the economy is intermediate production, is business-to-business sales. And this is what's very interesting. In an advancing economy in which people are saving money and they've increased their savings, which means that you're not consuming as much now because you wish to consume more in the future, that's what savings is all about. If you're counting final sales, it appears that the gross national product is declining. But it's not declining at all. It's just that you're having an expansion in the intermediate stages of production. As De Soto explains, the intermediate stages are lengthening, meaning you're having more stages of production, you're having more specialization, and they're widening, meaning you're expanding the stages that you already have. So you can have a booming economy in which people are working. You've got high employment, but yet if you count just final sales, GDP, the government says, well, GDP is falling. This can't be right. We've got to pump up the money supply. We've got to get people to spend more. No, people don't want to spend more. People want to save their money for the future.
Well, and what does it even mean when GDP rises 5%, that could mean that half the economy is increasing by 20% and the other half the economy is decreasing by 10%. I mean, it's just an aggregate that really doesn't say much about what's actually going on.
Well, and again, Drew, you can think if we all just decided to run our savings accounts to zero and go out and throw big parties and buy anything we wanted, buy new cars, and just forget about the future, the government would say the economy is booming. And after all that is gone, we would be bankrupt. We would have nothing left, and the American economy would stagnate because it wouldn't have any capital. So, I mean, I don't think it's that much different from an ordinary household. If I decide to spend all my savings and then borrow money on top of that because I've always been a good credit risk, people could look at me and say, boy, that Pat Barron must be doing great. Look what he's doing. He's taking trips here and there, and he's bought new cars, and he's building a swimming pool, whatever I'm doing. He's got horses. Who knows, But I'm just blowing it, and at the end of that, I'm a bank.
Yeah, you just made an interesting point with everything seems like a household. Austrians typically make the point that there's no such thing as macroeconomics. There's only microeconomics. And the difference that they've created with this macroeconomics is to try to, create different rules, create different economic laws that only governments have to adhere to.
Well, and also you can see it benefits big business because they love their macro indicators, and what better way to do that than to grant special privileges to some big businesses, you know, like the housing industry or the automobile industry, and ignore, you know, Main Street America. But their aggregates really mean nothing. All economics is the individual, and all aggregate is just adding up what the individuals do. So if you destroy all the incentives at the individual level, if you destroy the individual's ability to look to the future, to have confidence in the future, then the economy is going to stagnate, and no amount of money printing is going to cure that.
And these boom bust cycles, they never help everybody. The benefits go solely to the government and the big banks. These organizations, which Rothbard points out, they're built in secret. Call it a conspiracy theory if you have to, but it may or may not be. But ultimately, these boom bust cycles, they help the big banks, they help the government increase its power, and they hurt the little guy because everybody else is out on their butts and out without a job. It's just very unfortunate how it's sold as a bill of goods. We're told that these organizations help everybody, but in the actuality, they hurt everybody. And because of it, everybody's none the wiser.
Well, exactly. And you look at what has happened in America. In fact, it's happened pretty much all over the world, that the government is expanding everywhere, whether it's expanding for military spending or if it's expanding for welfare payments, buying votes. It's the government that is expanding, and it could not do that without the collusion, without the special relationship with the banks. And so rather than – it's all just a big conspiracy. I'm afraid that's – I hate to say that, but it's actually what it is. They may not view this as a conspiracy. I'm sure they rationalize their actions. But it is a way that they get – the government gets to do what it wants to do regardless of what the people desire.
Yeah. Because so, Pat, we're coming up here on our final break here on Radio Free Market.
Yeah.
Please stay tuned. After the break, we'll finish up and figure out how to get us out of this mess. Welcome back to Radio Free Market. I'm Drew Yell, and I'm talking with Patrick Barron about the mystery of banking. And I guess to make things a little bit more hopeful here, I guess what I want to kind of, you know, break down how to fix this, how to make everything better. And one of the distinctions that Rothbard makes in the book is that there's a difference between loan banking versus deposit banking. What exactly does he mean by that? How would that fix everything?
Well, this is I think the key point of his entire book. And that is, we are all used to, we deposit our paycheck or the, you know, Christmas money we get, we deposit it into the bank, and the bank can do with it as it wishes. And in Rothbard's view, he says if we get back to 100% reserves on deposits, you have a deposit bank in which your money is safe kept for you. It is not lent out. It is like a grain elevator. You may not get your exact $10 bill back that you put in, but you will get back a $10 bill or 2 5s and 10 1s. You will get back what you want because it's all right there. And that is the deposit bank. So there is a 100% reserves bait for that. And then there is the loan bank. Now, this may be under the same charter, but there would be a Chinese wall, so to speak, between the two. Now, the loan bank would operate. Now, that is where you loan the money to the banker for a set period of time, and the banker then loans the money to someone else, a business or an individual. And you do know that your money in the loan side of the bank is at risk. The risk is that the banker will not be able to pay you back. So you say, well, how? That's not very, very safe, is it? And you say, well, of course, it can be very safe because – then you would look at, well, what is the capital that the banker has at his own capital at risk in the loan bank, and what is the reputation of this banker? So these are the two things that no one ever cares about anymore. I mean, anymore when you go to the bank, you just look at, well, how convenient is the bank, and or do they have a special rates or something?
Well, when Rothbard talks about loan banking and the mystery of banking, what it sounds like to me is like when somebody puts money in the stock market, basically. Rather than putting in a bank where, you know, it's just carted off and could be possibly, you know, multiplied in infinity to how many different times it could be used, whereas you put money in the stock market, you have a fixed asset, so to speak.
Well, it's very, I think it is different. It is sort of like a stock market, but in a sense, you are giving the money to the bank that has a reputation and has its own capital that is backing you up, and you expect that the bank's going to say pay you 3% and it's going to lend the money out at 6 or 7%, and that's how it's going to make its money, is on the difference. But what you're looking at is you want to get your dollars back, the same dollars back, plus the little bit of interest, and your safety margin is the banker's capital. So let's just say the banker has $1 million worth of capital, and if he has $10 million worth of loans, then you can say, well, the banker would have to lose 10% of his loans would have to go bad before he would not be able to pay me off. And you can look at his history. He's never denied payment. He's been in business for years. He's a good community reputation. See, this gets back the way banking really was for a very long time. It was very locally based, and reputation was everything. The banker's reputation was very important, and the banker's capital was very important. These are things they're not concerned about anymore.
There was research done in the late 80s that by Kaufman that said that bank runs in the free banking era during the 19th century, people actually did tend to, you know, look for banks that had solid reputations back then, whereas nowadays you've got these big monster banks that nobody really cares about where their money goes.
Well, and of course, why do we not care about it? Because the government says it's guaranteeing our money for us. So,
and that's end it there. I really appreciate your time today. Thank you very much for being on the show today, Pat.
Thanks, Drew. I really appreciate you being my student the last 2 years. You could teach my class.
Well, that's it for today. Please visit us on the web at radiofreemarket.com, where you can subscribe for free to all of our podcasts, listen to all of our previous episodes, and also be notified of more shows in the future. So please, wherever you are, stand up for freedom. Thank you for listening.